we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
And the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show, Western Canada's only program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, December the 2nd, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-hosts, Caroline Carnery.
Hello there.
Jen Dobell.
Hi.
And our guest co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. So for our first interview today, we'll be speaking with Canadian film director Leora Eisen. She has just made a documentary film called Think Like an Animal, which you can view for free at cbc.ca/natureofthings. And in it, with David Suzuki, they explore new discoveries in understanding animal intelligence, from hummingbirds to sperm whales to iguanas to Esther the Wonder Pig. I saw the film myself this week, and I highly recommend watching it to learn more about the way animals think. Then for our feature interview, we'll be speaking with author and activist Robert Grillo, who we have had on the show before, but he's now just written a new book called Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture, in which he explores the many myths that human beings allow themselves to believe in order to continue using, abusing, killing, and eating animals while thinking it's perfectly okay to do so. This is a great book that logically discusses these reasons, and in today's interview, we'll be speaking with him to elaborate on the thoughts he has to share. That interview is coming up in about 24 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
All right, so first off, we're going to just talk a bit about the Vancouver Aquarium. We've got to discuss a few things here. There's been a lot going on. Two belugas have died in the past 9 days, the last two belugas at the aquarium. There have been demonstrations outside the aquarium by animal rights advocates to educate the public about issues which the aquarium is trying very hard to hide from us as well. And activists are also calling for the banning of any importation of new cetaceans and tank expansion, which is what the aquarium has planned right now. There's another big protest planned for this Sunday at 12:30 to 3:30 at the aquarium, and we encourage everyone to attend. You'll learn a lot from who's there and provide a voice for the animals. So, Jen, there was a park board meeting earlier this week, which animal rights advocates attended. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend, but about 20 animal rights advocates attended the meeting, which was open to the public. They stood up holding cardboard cutouts of tombstones, naming the cetaceans who had died all prematurely at the aquarium. One activist stated the following: "We ask you to immediately place a moratorium on the acquisition of any new cetaceans. Move forward toward a full ban of keeping these intelligent and sensitive individuals. Mandate that the Vancouver Aquarium is to become a facility that strictly only does rescue and rehabilitation, without additional captive individuals performing shows, serving as exhibits, or entertainment." The action was prompted by the recent deaths of two beluga whales. Since then, Park Board Chair Sarah Kirby Young suggested Vancouver hold a public vote on cetacean captivity. She then started the city down that path by filing a notice of motion at the November 28th meeting.
There's been some controversy over Sarah Kirby Young, actually. Some say she's working within a conflict of interest. So what's that all about?
6 years ago, she held the position of Vice President of Marketing and Communications with the Vancouver Aquarium, and currently she has a website, Sky Communications, which is a marketing company. The Vancouver Aquarium is listed as an employment reference, which would obviously garner business for her, so she clearly wouldn't want to do anything that has a negative impact on the aquarium, which would be a revenue-generating reference for her. On top of this, we have ethical issues with Sarah. She broke the rules of the Vancouver Charter. Once she and the NPA won the election, she publicly announced announced that she was going to reverse anything that the previous vision-dominated park board had proposed in regard to banning breeding and independent oversight. Her defense is that they ran a campaign platform saying that they weren't going to end whale captivity, but months before that, a public hearing brought forward a lot of information that they and the public didn't know, and Charter 2.5 says that you cannot ignore that information. Section 2.5 states that information must be revised prior to making decisions. It's their job to listen to the public. The NPA Park Board members never replied to one email or phone call from Gary Charbonneau regarding the additional information beyond his documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered. All four NPA members have ignored him, which is breaking the law.
So, yeah, there appears to be a pretty strong bias there, which is being ignored by Sarah Kirby Young. And we should expect more from publicly elected servants, shouldn't we? I mean...
Yes, exactly. She's pushing for a referendum in 2018, and we see no reason not to put a moratorium on aquarium expansion and bringing in more cetaceans to hold captive at the aquarium. It will sway voters if cetaceans are already in the tanks by then, as the public often says that they support captivity because they think the animals at the aquarium are rescued, and in most cases they're not. And they say, where will they go if they are released? They'll die in the ocean. We must stop breeding animals into captivity because it creates this problem. This isn't the life animals were destined for. It's cruel. So please see the petition by No Whales Captivity on our Facebook page, animalvoices.org. Sorry, Animal Voices Vancouver, and on our website, animalvoices.org.
All right, thanks for that update, Jen.
This is your big chance, so don't blow it. We're here to present the cutting-edge radio you want to hear. What about a program featuring just local Vancouver bands?
No market for that.
We have an expert on gospel music.
No.
Our public affairs programs dig deep with voices other stations won't touch.
No.
Programs with First Nations hosts?
Sorry, no market for that.
We've got a lot of shows in other languages for people all over the world. Folk music?
You're kidding, right? Who would sponsor that?
Can't make big bucks with programs people want to hear? You have to go to Co-op Radio for that. Community-owned radio. Now at 100.5 FM. The switch is on.
All right, what have we got this week? The OSPCA in Ontario has charged Marineland with five counts of animal cruelty, I believe. Sorry, a little scattered here. Microphone falling out of here. So Marineland has been charged with permitting animals to be in distress and failing to comply with the prescribed standards of care. In the case of 35 black bears, the zoo was charged with failing to provide adequate and appropriate food and water. So Marineland has said that the complaint was made by a former animal care worker who was fired for poor performance and inappropriate behavior. And so they say that it's just somebody lashing out at them and that this doesn't matter, you know, that there wasn't actually an issue. The OSPCA said that they are just doing their job as the law is written, and that's what happened in this case. So they're still investigating. No animals have been removed, but the OSPCA is keeping an eye on the animals there to see if they're going to need to remove anybody. But so we'll post some more information on that on our page. And something else that happened this week was the pit bull ban in Montreal. It was put in place in September, and then it was suspended in October after a lot of backlash. So the suspension this week has now been been lifted, unfortunately. So, but as part of the court's decision, the City of Montreal has agreed not to apply certain provisions of its bylaw until a superior court hearing on its merits early next year. So they've agreed not to euthanize any pit bull type dogs unless they are found to be dangerous or show signs of becoming dangerous or if they are stray, sick, or badly hurt. Shelters will also be allowed to return lost pit bulls to their owners rather than just euthanizing them. And the city's also agreed that pit bulls can be put up for adoption if they are destined for homes outside of Montreal. So it's, pretty weird, messed up stuff going on over there that is not ultimately helping dogs. So, we'll be posting more information on that on our page as well. So keep an eye out.
Yeah, and I think we should investigate this topic for further in the future, because it's really quite crazy. Like, it's a real I want to say speciesist, but it's like it's actually towards one breed, and that's just terrible, especially in Canada, right? Where, mm-hmm. you know, we're supposed to have animal welfare laws, but I don't know. What do you think about that, Caroline? Because you have a lot of experience with dogs.
Well, I think that we've seen this legislation come and go several times, and in Ontario, there is, in fact, breed-specific legislation in place. I know when I lived in Alberta, one of the breeds that they were trying to outlaw at that time was Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and I had my companion animal was a Rhodesian Ridgeback. And so this legislation does come and go, and sometimes it sticks. So I think it's just really important to be vigilant. And if you've got an opinion about it, you have to state it loudly, because once the time has passed, it's always much harder to reverse something at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for the news, Sinead. And now we have our first interview.
Today we're joined by Leora Eisen, who is an award-winning journalist and filmmaker specializing in documentaries. Her work has appeared on CBC Radio Canada, TVO, Discovery, History Network, just to name a few. And she has also acted as a senior producer in CBC's independent documentary unit. Leora is a recipient of a Gemini Award, 2 Gemini nominations, and the Dave Rogers Award for Best Feature Documentary. Last week, her documentary, Think Like an Animal, aired on CBC's The Nature of Things, and we welcome her here today to discuss some of the main findings of that film. Leora, thank you very much for joining us on Animal Voices today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I just watched the film, Think Like an Animal, the other day, and you know, really enjoyed learning about the different intelligence and adaptations of non-human animals. But before we delve into that content of your film, can you tell us first about where your motivation came from to even make a film on this subject?
Well, a couple of things. One, who wouldn't want to run around the world and see sperm whales and vervet monkeys? But aside from that, the executive producer of The Nature of Things, my colleague Sue Dando, had read a review of a book by Carl Safina, and he's a really well-known American ecologist. He's written a lot of books about animals, and he had written a new book, which I recommend. It's called Beyond Words, How Animals Think and Feel. And he wanted to explore this idea of how are animals like us, and then he realized he was asking the wrong question. It's not about how animals are like us. And I started looking into it, and there's a whole bevy of research out there, of new research about species we don't normally think of as quote-unquote intelligent. You know, we think of primates, we think of dolphins, but, you know, when's the last time you thought about fish as particularly smart, or bearded dragons, or pigs? We thought it was time for a new look at animal intelligence.
Right. And, you know, historically as a species, we've assigned intelligence to animals in reference to our own species. We often talk about giving certain animals, like chimpanzees, the rights of persons as they show intelligence, which mirrors our own. And, the father of evolutionary science, Darwin, viewed non-animals in his research from a very human-centric outlook. And so those animals who have dissimilar, intelligence are downgraded by us in terms of respect and treatment. And what I really like about your film is that it turns this on its ears, and it looks at animals in their own environment and how different intelligence, basically has adapted for survival. And you put a lens, a non-human lens on this. So let's talk about a few of the intelligences that you explored. So let's start it with the sperm whales, because I've got to say that that really took my breath away, what we learned there.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of research out there on other whales, orcas and humpbacks, but sperm whales have been notoriously difficult to study, basically because they travel thousands of kilometers, they're nomadic, and they dive really, really deep. And so it's only recently that scientists have really begun to understand them. And Shane Garrow, a Canadian researcher, has been spending over a decade, a couple months a year, in Dominica, this little tiny island in the Caribbean, where these incredible families of sperm whales live and communicate with each other. And we have this image of, you know, from Moby Dick, of these huge monsters, and they are big, you know. Even a calf can be the size of a school bus. But they need to communicate with each other because they have a really complicated society. They're matrilineal, meaning female families. The guys kind of take off when they're teenagers to look for mates. We're all sort of familiar with that idea. So it's grandmothers, mothers, sisters, daughters, sons living together. And they need to be able to find out, okay, who are you? Are you my friend? Are you my enemy? How did you treat me last time I saw you? When they encounter other whales in the deep. The other thing that I found really cool about this is that they babysit each other's children. So when mom goes to take a deep dive to get a squid towards the bottom, if the baby's not capable of doing that yet, another female will be babysitting baby on the surface. So they really have to be able to establish trust. And in order to do that, they communicate by a series of clicks, and Shane describes it as sounding like popcorn popping, and when you hear it, that's exactly what it sounds like. And he's been able to figure out that what they're doing is identifying themselves. So it's like saying, hi, my name's Leora, I'm from the family called Eisen, and I'm Canadian. It's just incredible. And in order to remember all of the social relationships that you have and communicate them, you need to be able, you need a high capacity for intelligence. They have a lot of brain power. They have the biggest brain on the planet. But what I found really interesting is brain size isn't all that matters. There's always this debate amongst researchers specializing in animal behavior and neuroscience, you know, how much does brain size matter? And the answer is it's kind of complicated. It's not the only determinant.
And in fact, we're going to move right into talking about an animal with one of the smallest brains. And I know that Sinead has a question about you on the rufous hummingbirds.
Yeah, yeah. So you had the big animals and the small animals in there. So the hummingbirds, the rufous hummingbirds in your documentary were demonstrated to have an episodic memory with respect to finding food. So yeah. Why is that so important? Important to hummingbirds in their own habitat?
Well, for one thing, I found it fascinating just because these are these beautiful animals that come to the Rockies every spring. And they their brain is just around the size, maybe a little bit bigger than the size of a grain of rice. Okay? And yet they can recall where certain flowers are amid hundreds, if not thousands, of flowers to get nectar, but not just where they are, but when they last ate from them. And the key is, what that demonstrates, too, is brain power is related to biology. You know, with all this emphasis on neuroscience, we think of the brain as like this computer that's separate from an animal's body. And it's not. They need to eat about every 10 minutes because they have a really high metabolism. You know, their wings are always flapping, their hearts are always beating. That's why, you know, you're trying to take a picture of a hummingbird and they're gone before you know it. And so they need to sustain themselves by frequent eating. And if they go back to a flower they just ate from, they could die. And so these researchers who are doing this great study that's really low tech. It's basically little sticks with a cardboard circle on it, and they put sugar water in it, and it represents flowers. And the same single bird will come back again and again, remembering which flowers it last ate from. And, I just found them fascinating, beautiful to watch. And the scientists have been studying them for 25 years, and they're still blown away by the episodic memories of these birds.
You know, sometimes I feel like I eat every 10 minutes, but I know I'm not going to die if although well, sometimes exactly. I say I will.
But what that shows is why it's important to study animals in the context of their own environment. You know, they don't necessarily need to know math or play chess, as one of our scientists say. They do need to have episodic memory because it's important to their survival. So when we put humans at the pinnacle of intelligence, you know, different animals have evolved to be sort of specialists in certain areas that are crucial to their survival. And just because some animals can't see themselves in a mirror, which is, you know, a sort of perennial science test, or perform certain tasks that we do, it doesn't matter if they don't need to. It doesn't mean they're not intelligent.
Exactly. And moving on now to some what was called in the film the pinnacle of social learning, imitation. What did we see from the bearded dragons
really
there? I was fascinated by that.
First of all, it's a researcher studying bearded dragons, and I made sure anybody that was in the film was a very humane scientist and really took care to treat their animals with the respect that they deserve. So just so you know that, because this was in a lab, but these bearded dragons that she has, watch a movie, a little 11-second video. In the movie, another lizard opens a gate to get to a worm on the other side. And what blew me away was if the movie lizard opens it to the right, the viewing bearded dragon lizard does the same thing. If the movie lizard opens the gate to the left, the viewing lizard does it the same way. And so then I thought, okay, well, you know, maybe this is just luck or maybe this is instinct. But no, because she also has a control group of lizards that watch a movie where the gate kind of opens by magic, but the lizard doesn't do it. Well, the control group couldn't figure out how to open the gate. So it means that they're learning how to access the goal by watching the behavior of another animal. That was incredible to me. And they're beautiful, beautiful animals.
Yes, I really enjoyed watching that particular part and just seeing the exact imitation. So, that's incredible. Now, I'm just wondering what your biggest takeaway from, you know, making this documentary, because I know for a fact we are hoping you make more of this sort.
Oh, thank you. Well, I hope so, too. But I think the biggest takeaway for me was that science isn't important just for science's sake. You know, it's tied to animal welfare, too. If, you know, unfortunately, we do measure things in terms of our own world, and we value intelligence. And so if we understand that pigs, for example, and there's some wonderful pigs, including Esther the pig in this film, that they have thoughts and feelings, that they have emotions, that they need room to play, that they need to be cared for properly because they need mental stimulation. If we understand that they do have thoughts and feelings and aren't just like these robot farm animals that we put on our plates, maybe we actually will value taking care of them better. So that was the biggest takeaway for me. And just so your listeners know, the film is available online at any time if you go to CBC's Nature of Things website.
And I highly recommend the film. It was just excellent. Thank you so much for joining us on Animal Voices. And once again, please keep telling these stories and of how animals use different intelligence to help them survive in their habitats.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Have a good day, Leora.
You too. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Our feature interview today is with Robert Grillo, an activist, author, and speaker. He is the director of the organization Free From Harm, which he founded in 2009 to expose animal agriculture's impact on non-human animals, vulnerable communities, and the environment. In his first and just published book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture, Robert dissects the cultural forces that drive our food choices and the reasons for the notion that we have a right to consume non-human animals. Today he will be speaking to us about some of these reasons to draw a better understanding of where these beliefs derive from and why. Hello, Robert, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show today to speak with us about your new book, Farm to Fable. I have really been enjoying reading it this past week, and thank you for writing such a book that really examines our culture's perspective on animals and exposes humans' beliefs for what they really are on this matter. Many people believe that animals are here for us to use and that it's perfectly okay to use and abuse and kill them, and this never gets questioned in our society. I'd like to think that most people are compassionate beings, but there's a large disconnect here when the consideration for animals is involved. So how does that start, Robert? Because I think that as children, we are pure and we are compassionate. For the most part, at least, I always say we are born as vegans, and then that somehow is lost along the way. So can you talk about children and how they begin to lose the ability to empathize and care for other beings, which then brings us into our adulthood?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let me just kind of preface that by saying that I don't claim to be an authority on child psychology or sociology. However, from the standpoint of a marketing communications branding person, I think there are some insights that we can glean from that perspective and how it influences children and tells them basically that a rite of passage into adulthood is kind of letting go of our concern for certain groups of animals. And there are a couple of researchers that I talk about in the book, Stewart and Cole, that have done quite a bit of interesting research and reporting on this phenomenon. And they look at children's literature and popular films and popular characters in films like The Lion King and Babe and all of these different films and stories. And they find some very interesting patterns there. They find that farm animals are often portrayed as faceless and anonymous and having no real individual characteristics at all, right? But then some other characters like the Lion King, the lion in the Lion King is noble and very individual, very intelligent, all of these really, you know, strong characteristics. And so, of course, that's fictional, right? Because we know that if one animal has that, then all animals have that. Just like humans have different personalities and different traits that we all do. So that, of course, applies to, you know, all species. That's something that, you know, and we see so much marketing that is so much that is directed at children. So in my own experience, like as a marketing and designer, I worked at agencies that marketed to children, like McDonald's does. McDonald's has these elaborate, you know, Happy Meal boxes that I once used to work on before I got into any of this years and years ago. And, you know, what's striking about that is the animals, the happy and fun farm animals on the package are containing the body parts of those same animals that live miserable lives. And, you know, the contrast couldn't be any more striking.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, we grow up with those messages as children into adulthood. Do you think that people as adults have lost the ability to care and to empathize, or do they just need to learn how to align care with actions?
Very interesting question. And I think there's no real easy answer. But one of the things that I saw that I thought was rather encouraging not too long ago was a BBC series called Sex, Death, and the Meaning of Life, which is narrated and hosted by Richard Dawkins, who, as you probably know, is the world's most famous evolutionary biologist. And he tells us that the science shows us that humans are hardwired to have empathy, and that scientists can now, you know, scan the brain and tell us how we experience pain and pleasure. And that at one point he says, to quote him, "We can trace the chemicals in the brain that reward kindness. We can see what goes on in the brain when we feel for others. Goodness is natural to us. Kindness is our physiology," end quote. He's very certain that this is so. And because of the science and the background, the scientific research that's been done. So from a scientific perspective, we seem to know that. Of course, there's lots of debate about that. And how do we, our job as activists is to re-trigger the empathy, to turn, you know, an apathetic attitude into an empathic one. And I think we all struggle with how that can be done because, of course, human beings are so complex and some respond better to certain things than others. So it's a complex question.
Yeah, definitely different methods work for different people, and we are always exploring that on our show. So in your book, you talk about cultural hegemony, and exploring this is largely what the book is about. What is cultural hegemony as it relates to humans' views on animals?
Cultural hegemony is largely attributed to Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci, who was a wonderful thinker, one of the people that has really inspired me quite a bit in exploring this topic. And so Gramsci grew up under the reign of Mussolini. He grew up in a very oppressive fascist regime. And he was imprisoned by Mussolini because he was considered the leading anti-fascist intellectual at the time. And it was in prison that he wrote thousands of pages of manuscript. And one of the ideas that he put forth was cultural hegemony. And he defines this as the kind of cultural, it's cultural tyranny. It's the attempt to control the public mind through the powers that be so that the habits and values and beliefs and customs of that powerful class becomes the normal, becomes presented as the normal that we all should aspire to.
So one of the branches of cultural hegemony, I think, comes from the myths that exist in our society that indicate that animals consent to the treatment we put upon them. I see this largely in the media myself and on, as you were talking about, packaging of animal products. Can you give us some examples of these myths of consent?
Well, first, I think it's important to recognize for everyone that these myths are, they have very ancient roots. I think you can go back to early civilization times. I think it goes back to civilization's first inklings. And so as soon as we started mass producing animals and domesticating them, for example, lots of people don't even know, but in ancient Egypt, some of the first earliest civilizations had already learned to mass produce eggs. So once they had created artificial incubation, they were able to mass produce thousands of chicken eggs a day. So this goes back so far. We think of factory farming as a modern thing, but actually it has ancient roots. And so consent is the idea that animals are willing participants in whatever it is we'd like to do with them. And of course, this comes out of the whole tradition of using animals against their will. It's kind of a guilt response to taking someone that doesn't want to do something, doesn't want to be enslaved and confined and killed for someone else's use, and creating a fictional device that will kind of convince people that this practice is actually okay. And you asked about modern, like a modern counterpart to that. So in my presentation, I look at Krishna milking the sacred cow as kind of an ancient example, and then I compare that visually with the packaging on Organic Valley milk packaging in the U.S. And it's really interesting because the two portraits are just so similar. One has Krishna milking the sacred cow, and it's a very benevolent, pastoral scene. And the other one replaces Krishna with a family farmer and their children, affectionately petting their dairy cows on an open pasture. So the two scenes are just so strikingly similar, even though they're thousands of years apart.
Well, I want to talk about everyday language now. It has the power to either hide or expose the truth. Just a few weeks ago on the show, we were talking about popular idioms regarding animals, and there were many that we didn't have time to get to. So one that I wanted to talk about was the term harvesting. Also, I find it very interesting what you say about the word meat and the implications that even this basic word in our vocabulary has on our cultural beliefs. So can you tell us about these two terms, please, harvesting and meat? How do we view them in society and what do they really mean?
Yeah, those are both pretty powerful ones that you picked out there. Harvesting is a little easier, I would say. Meat's a little bit more complex in its meaning, but harvesting is really just kind of, for me, a replacement of the word killing or slaughtering. It's a word that actually kind of equates or blurs the distinction between plants and animals so that, you know, plucking a carrot out of the ground, which is harvesting, a carrot is kind of synonymous with chopping the head off of a chicken, like as if animals just grow in the ground or they're pieces of fruit that we pluck off of a tree. Of course, that's why it's so fictional, is because it tries to connect those two things, which are so different. So it's really just a nice word for killing. But meat is much more complicated. And I think one of the great authors, thinkers that really started me thinking more deeply about meat is Carol Adams, and specifically her book, The Sexual Politics of Meat. And in that book, she really explores the connection between the disempowerment of women, of female bodies, with animal bodies, and how being called a piece of meat or referred to as a piece of meat, how they're connected between humans and other animals. And I think once you've referred to someone as a piece of meat, you've completely just annihilated any other value or identifying characteristic of that being, who that being once was. Now they're just an object of consumption.
So you've talked about the myth of consent, but can you tell us about some of the other fictions we are told about farmed animals to make us feel better about exploiting them, and how the power of money plays a major role in perpetuating mm-hmm. these fictions?
So consent is the first fiction that I talk about in the book. And the reason why that comes first and some of the others come later is because you have to believe in consent first to believe in these other fictions that are built upon them. So we have to believe that animals are willing participants and that they don't mind being used, to then have the focus of conversation just be on how well do we treat them or how poorly are they treated. And that's where humane washing comes in. And I think that's going to be our biggest challenge moving forward is challenging the humane washing fictions. Because what these humane washing fictions say is basically it's just a matter of how we treat animals. It completely ignores the use factor and if use is actually a form of abuse, which I would argue it definitely is. In fact, it's probably the greatest transgression is the use factor. Other common fictions that I discuss in the book are naturalism, the idea of eating animals being natural biologically from an evolutionary standpoint. I talk about a necessity as an important fiction. A recent survey showed that Americans believe that eating animals is necessary by some 66%, which was astounding to me. I talk about denigration as a form, as a fictional device, how we use animal names to denigrate ourselves, groups that we don't like, and also animals, like being a chicken or a pig or a fat cow or a filthy, you know, dirty rat, these kind of things. And we use things like an appeal to masculinity. We use sexualization as a fictional device to make animals appear more consumable by making them look sexy. There's probably a good 25 to 30 different fictions that I look at in the book.
Yeah, and people really need to read this book to really discover all those, I think. So I want to talk about hunters because you make some salient points about them in your book. Now, humans aren't obligate carnivores. And in fact, just last week, I read that only 10% of the animals on Earth are actually carnivores, which I didn't know that before. So we're far from it. And in your book, you say that true carnivores kill and eat prey for survival, which is fundamentally different from those who kill for sport and ego fulfillment and who post photos of their trophy kill on Facebook. So please, what would you like to say about hunters? And what do you say to people who think that hunting is our true nature?
Yeah, one of the books that I think has some of the greatest insight on hunting and what hunting symbolizes in our culture is Jim Mason's book, An Unnatural Order. I love the way he describes what it means for us, because even people that don't hunt, even the general public, he says, tacitly supports hunting through a tax-supported game management bureaucracy that controls the nation's wildlife and our parks, refuges, and wilderness areas. No other sport is as pampered and privileged, for no other sport does so much to champion the myths and values of a meat-hungry, dominionist society. I think he kind of hits the nail on the head right there, and that could possibly explain why, if only 5% of the population, roughly, in the U.S., and perhaps in Canada too, are hunters, why is it that the laws seem to be so slated in favor of hunting and gaming and fishing? And perhaps Mason is kind of pointing to that hunting is believed to kind of preserve our dominionist relationship with the natural world and to control populations, animal populations that would otherwise become a nuisance to us. So I think these are the beliefs that put hunters on a pedestal as some kind of heroes of conservation and of the environment.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the film called Blood Lions that was recently released in the last year. We had the director of that film on. It's about hunting, and they were interviewing some hunters who really, truly, and honestly, from their core, believed that they were doing a good thing and that they were conserving from killing these animals, and a lot of them actually being endangered animals in far off countries. So it's just, I think it's something that we need to keep prodding that topic on the show here for people to actually really think about, because unless it's discussed, like all the subjects that you covered in your book, it's not going to be considered. I think hunting leads into our human superiority complex and how that affects the animals. Many people think and say that humans are more important than animals and that they would always put a human before an animal. So can you talk about how humans assert their superiority over animals and why it's not a reason to harm them?
So I think that we use these false kind of arguments about being in conflict. And see, this all goes back to what Jim Mason was saying, that we're in conflict with the natural world and it's our enemy. So we have to conquer it or be conquered. It's going to kill us if we don't kill it. That's been a dominant dominionist kind of worldview that he's talked about for centuries. It is still so pervasive today. You know, I think brands and corporations know very well that consumption, the consumption of the animal, is the ultimate act of conquest over them. And so that's where the superiority, we can consume them, we can mass consume them, and that is the most powerful force against them, because once we consume them, they're us, they're part of us, they no longer exist, and they nourish us. So I think that's a big part of the superiority fiction.
Yeah, and there's also invisibility, which you're talking about in your book. Social psychologist and inventor of the term carnism, Dr. Melanie Joy, identifies invisibility as an important mechanism for maintaining the dominant carnistic culture, as is superiority. You say it's no accident that we rarely, if ever, get to meet these animals who are being misrepresented. So can you tell us about invisibility and the role it plays in denial and therefore allowing ourselves to think it's okay to use and abuse animals? And maybe you can also touch upon the term carnism as well for those who haven't heard of it before.
Sure. I believe carnism is attributed to social psychologist Melanie Joy, who you mentioned. Carnism being what she calls the invisible belief system of the dominant meat-eating culture. And yeah, I do agree very much. And the reason why I mention it in the book is that I think she definitely hit on something very important when she talks about invisibility. And it becomes a fictional device when the fact of the matter is that there's 32 farm animals for any given human being at any given time. So there's 32 times as many farm animals, and yet most people will never see them or never hear about them as living beings. They only know of them as abstract body parts, abstract products that they buy in the store. But the interesting phenomenon that's happening, I think, now in reaction to this kind of exposing of carnism is visibility used, the opposite actually being used as a fictional device. For example, what I call visibility in the book is kind of like the foodie, humane, sustainable movement's reaction to this invisibility factor. And they're saying, well, okay, yes, you're right. So now what it means is that we must bring this out into the open. And if we witness and if we partake in violence against animals, that somehow makes it ethical. So now you're seeing things like, you know, slaughter classes and workshops, different like homesteader, kind of like sustainable movement type people and organizations. And they're killing animals in public view, and they're basically claiming that visibility makes it ethical. But of course, if these were other animals like cats or dogs or horses, we would be mortified by it. So that's the proof that it's a cultural construct, and it has nothing to do with visibility making it acceptable.
So there is a way to connect with these animals and to get to know them as individuals, and a person can do this by visiting a local animal sanctuary. Now, I've talked to people before who don't even know what an animal sanctuary is, which is shocking to me since I've visited so many of them myself. But can you tell us about animal sanctuaries and their importance in helping visitors learn a new paradigm for understanding animals?
Sanctuaries are places where farm animals are somehow they escape the grasp of exploitation and they're being given a second chance at life. And they're being raised in an environment where they can actually, for the first time, maybe express their true nature. So, you know, while we don't have a sanctuary, we do rescue domestic birds like chickens, and we find permanent homes for them. But we've had a wonderful opportunity to really get to know who these animals are and document their lives through video and images so that we can have people online have a virtual experience, a sanctuary experience, if you will. So it's kind of the next best thing to being there. You know, like most of these people, like you said, will never actually meet a farm animal. So if that's the case and they can't find a sanctuary, then they can kind of quasi-experience that online. And I would say that could be pretty powerful for some people as well.
Yeah, I think that's a major facet of the outreach that a lot of sanctuaries do is you can't just have the animals as ambassadors on the sanctuary for the locals to visit, but we have the power of the internet now, and that's how people are really learning about individual stories of animals and who they are for the individuals that they are. So one final topic to talk about that you cover in your book is the subject of morality. You say if animals matter to us, even only marginally, then we don't violate their most basic right to life and liberty when we can easily avoid it. I agree. So how do we get to that in our moral progress when we are so far away from that right now as a whole population? What is the moral shift that needs to be made?
Well, Dan, I feel like I kind of have to just preface my answer by saying that I don't claim to be an authority or expert on social change, but I think that there are some really compelling insights that come out of a better understanding of the fictions of animal consumption. And I think that they should be something that to give us pause and also to give us direction. I talk a bit about Gramsci in the book because he is one of those figures that can be very inspirational for us. He has been behind many successful social change movements around the world. And Gramsci emphasized what he called a counter-hegemonic movement. In other words, it's a battle of truth and education over fiction and propaganda. And so Gramsci argued that the cultural hegemony that's established by an oppressive regime can only be defeated through a counter-hegemonic movement that successfully embarks on what he calls a war of position through a prolonged intellectual, cultural, and moral confrontation over contemporary common sense conceptions of reality. So what he's really saying is that people like us, we build and develop a movement and we organize and educate the masses through consent until such time where there's a tipping point and things start working in our favor. And I think we're getting there. but we certainly have a long road.
Yeah, I think we're getting there as well. You say that animal advocacy, like other social justice movements, asks us to confront difficult realities, but the ultimate reward goes to those who have the courage to witness, because seeing things as they really are liberates us from oppression. So for your final words, what would you like to say to our listeners to empower them to look beyond the myths, the mainstream media, our cultural hegemony, in order to see the true picture and to be liberated?
I would just say that witnessing is just as difficult as it is critical, I think, for being able to identify with the actual victim. And not just in our movement, but in any other kind of social justice movement where victims are concealed, where their suffering is concealed. It's first and foremost incredibly important for us to be able to identify with them and sympathize with their situation, to try to do something to help them. In our case, we're dealing with an industry that uses lies and fictions to conceal its victims and what it does to them. Once we have that witnessing, our next task is how do we communicate with the public and how do we build awareness about this? And I think truth has to be at the core of that advocacy, because we're dealing with an industry built upon lies and fiction. So I emphasize what I call truth-centeredness in the book, and I talk a little bit about that. And I also talk about the important connection between beliefs and behavior, and that we make sure we understand that as part of our advocacy as well.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Robert, to speak to us about some of the issues covered in your book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture. To learn more, and there's a lot more in this book to know about, you can read the book. It's available on both Amazon and at veganpublishers.com. It's an essential read for anyone who considers themselves a conscious consumer. And I also encourage people to go to your website, freefromharm.org. Thank you so much for your time with us today, Robert. Have a good day.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Allison. Bye-bye.
So what did you think of that interview? Because I recorded that prior to today, and it's a great book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture. I brought it here actually for you too, if you want to take a look at it.
Yeah.
Lots of great ideas discussed. Huh?
You're going to have to fight me for it, Sinead, because there were so many references in that interview that I thought I have to go back to. Like, I really have to look at this study that Richard Dawkins has been involved in with respect to... Now, this sounds completely different than the selfish gene stuff that Richard Dawkins has done before. This sounds like, mm-hmm. you know, like there's a real evolutionary basis in kindness, and that they can, and it's measurable. And I think that that's riveting.
Yeah, I was really encouraged to hear that. I didn't know about that research that had been done. I mean, that was a long time ago, but because I always think that, yeah, we are kind. People are compassionate. There are psychopaths. As I think maybe you or someone else told me, there's more psychopaths in this world than I had been led to believe there are. So, but there is hope for most of us, right? And I asked him about, you know, do we need to resuscitate our compassion? Because we are kind and we are compassionate, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I really loved how he, you know, really focused on the war that needs to be fought here. And I hate to use war references, but it really is a war of position, as he says. And the battle must be not emotional. It must be about truth and facts and truth and facts and bringing this out of behind closed doors and putting it in front of people. Yeah. And, you know, which really troubles me about what's going on in Facebook right now, because they closed down the graphic content. And as we all know, Facebook has been a primary way that we've shared information. And now, you know, you can show your roast dinner or your roast turkey
That's
on your Facebook. Yes, it is. But it's, again, it's normalized where some of the videos now are being chopped out because they're too graphic. So we can, you know, there's the hypocrisy in that, of course. So, you know, it's just a real reminder as an activist that we just always have to not be baited into that emotional dialogue, but we have to go back to the fact, back to the truth, and the truth is good enough, and we just have to mm-hmm. keep putting it out there.
And that's why I wanted to do this interview with Robert as well, because it, and I mentioned this in the interview, is it, we need to put it out there in order for it to first be considered, and then in order for people to use that consideration to then draw their own conclusions instead of being indoctrinated by the cultural hegemony, right? Mm-hmm. Which is what the book is largely about. Yeah, well, to be continued, right? We're always talking about this stuff here on Animal Voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll have to borrow that book after Carolyn, because I'm busy reading Robin Lamont right now, who we're actually going to have on the show next week. So, yeah, you've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, December the 9th.
It's International Human Rights Day on December the 10th.
Yeah. And so, Allison, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what we've got going on next week?
Well, you're conducting the main interview, so yeah. We're going to be having Robin Lamont. She's an author. She's a vegan activist, animal rights activist. We've had her on the show before to speak about some other issues, but she's an author and she writes these suspense thriller novels that have to do with animal rights. I haven't read them yet, but I've read part of The Trap that came out this year. It was so good. You've read the first one, The Chain.
Mm-hmm.
Shauna has read The Trap, and there are some mentions of the interrelations between human rights and animal rights.
Absolutely.
So we're going to have her on the show to discuss that and tell more about these books and how you conduct animal activism through fiction novel writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then for our first interview, we're going to be having Annalise Sorg from No Whales in Captivity on the show. And she'll be giving us a further update, like a more in-depth update as to what's happening with the Vancouver Aquarium in light of the two recent beluga deaths and how they have been interacting and communicating with both the public, the mainstream media, and animal rights activists. So that's coming up next week.
Wonderful. So definitely tune in for that. That's going to be a good show. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts. Read our show blog with detailed links and subscribe via iTunes. You can stay in touch with us via our Facebook page as well, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can send us suggestions and comments about the show as well, either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And just a couple of events I want to squish in here at the end. Tomorrow at the Van City Theater, there's a screening at 2 p.m. of the documentary When Elephants Were Young, which is about elephants in Thailand and the things that they're facing. It's a really great documentary.
All of us have seen it, right?
Yes, we have.
We interviewed Patricia Sims, the filmmaker.
It's just excellent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't recommend
it. Yeah, I think
it
she's
going to
be at the screening too, if I'm not mistaken. That's tomorrow.
So. Yeah, so yeah, tomorrow, December 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Van City Theater. And if you want to look up her interview, we had a good interview with her as well. So that's mm-hmm. on our website. And, of course, don't forget this Sunday, a rally at the aquarium to make it known we don't want any more cetaceans imported into Stanley Park. So this is a very important rally. It's from 12:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. this Sunday. Don't forget, come out, bring your friends, bring your kids, and let's make a time of it.
I'm going to drag my friend there. He's always saying he doesn't support cetaceans in captivity, even though he's got some animal rights views, but not all like fully interconnected. So I'm dragging him because he's always asking, when's the next protest? When's the next protest? And I told him, it's this Sunday.
Well,
Let's go.
I think we all just have to get there.
We need
media,
numbers there.
Yeah, the media is listening. And if, you know, just a few people come out, then what does that say about our commitment to these beautiful, beautiful animals? We need to get there. We need to bring our friends and we need to bring our families. These demonstrations are family friendly.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to close with this song. Allison, can you tell us about this song?
All I Know. It's called A Love Song for Humanity. It's by Jamie Sieber. She's a cellist, and I think it's beautiful. It talks about, depicts what we've been talking about on the show today.
Wonderful. Thanks for that, Allison. Well, stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.